Hey everyone, welcome back to the Blessed Child Podcast. This is your host Renee, aka Run Robot. Just a reminder, if you enjoy this podcast, remember to like, share, and rate after you give this a listen. In this episode, I have invited a guest, Kale, back to the show. Kale is a 30-year-old white non-binary queer person. They grew up in the unceded Ohlone territory, the San Francisco Bay Area. Kale is currently organizing with UCRFT. They are an internationally anti-imperialist ex-member educational collective, aka reading group, discussing the Unification Church as a reflection and tool of fascism. I'm going to attach some contact info for Kale and the organization in the show notes. Kale is organizing with UCRFT and is intentionally inviting anyone interested to join to get into contact with them. A little more about Kale. Kale has a master's in clinical psychology from Columbia University and is currently working as a psychiatric patients' rights advocate, providing representation for individuals receiving involuntary mental health care. This is totally in line with our upbringing, and I am so honored to have Kale, someone that is such a powerful voice for people that cannot advocate for themselves in an oppressive system. I am so honored to have them on this show. Kale is also going to be in a book publicly talking about their experiences with the mental health involuntary system from personal experience when they went into psychosis themselves. So, the book is going to be Your Consent is Not Required, The Rise in Psychiatric Detentions, Forced Treatment, and Abusive Guardianship by Rob Wiepond. So, without further ado, let's get into the episode. I will be talking with Kale about growing up in the Unification Church and identifying as a queer, non-binary person. Trigger warning, we do get into talk of... sexual development, possibly sexual trauma. Yes, sexual trauma. If you grew up in the Unification Church, you without a doubt have sexual trauma. And we just get into it. We do a little bit of rambling. I enjoyed this episode. Trigger warning, I did get stuck in some flashbacks. And Kale, with their psychiatric background, was able to ground me and talk me back into the episode. So this one is really interesting. We might have some viewpoints that you don't agree with, and that's fine. We're just creating the language and having a good time. So listen with caution. Trigger, you might get stuck in a flashback, as I did. And for comfort, we'll talk you back. So here we go. So welcome back, Kale.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. I reached out to you because it's Pride Month coming up in June. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Heck yeah. So let's celebrate. Let's get the unique perspective of coming out not only queer, but coming out moony and queer and those intersections, because I think that's extremely difficult to do. And I commend your bravery for being able to do that and come talking with us about that journey and that experience.
Thanks. I feel like I didn't have any other choice. Just had to go through it and get to where I am. Just got to survive any way you can, you know?
Yeah. Survive any way you can. And you did. So that's also kind of rare. So let's get into whatever you feel comfortable. We can start with your childhood, if you like.
Sure. Let me just start. I'm 30 years old. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I have three other siblings. I think my parents moved to the Bay Area in, 89. During the hometown Providence thing. My dad also grew up in the Bay Area. And I grew up in Concord, which is about, 40 minutes from where the church center was in San Leandro. As a small child, the church center was in Berkeley, which is a little closer. So I think at that time we were more involved. But
hometown Providence, I remember this. So let's go back. Your parents are first generation Moonies. They were matched. Mm-hmm.
Yes, matched and blessed in 82. I think my mom wasn't supposed to be ready for the matching. Like she was supposed to be too young, but they had more brothers and sisters. They pulled her and like a couple of her friends from the overflow room.
What?
Yeah, what a crazy experience.
How old
to not
was
be? Oh gosh, how old was she?
Too young.
She was born in 54. So 82 minus 54. She wasn't. She was 28. So she was, I think, actually a lot older than we were when they started wanting us to get
Maybe
married.
She didn't finish her MFT course or anything. Like it's 7 years until they get matched.
Oh, that is 7 years.
Yeah.
She joined at 21. So that would have been the end of her 7 years.
Yeah. And some I know that I think American women had to do like 7 years on MFT, like to earn the right to be marriage trafficked to a total stranger.
100%.
Yeah.
And I know that she had a couple of spiritual children, one of whom was like matched to one of my friend's parents.
Okay.
But he rejected that matching. So I'm not sure what happened to him after that, but like that kind of bonded my mom and this other woman, especially when they both ended up back in the Bay Area. That was my best friend's mom.
I can't help but look at this with a human trafficking lens. Like when we say spiritual children, I now think pimping and grooming and getting new targets. Like that's all I can think.
Yeah. And you know, the new providence is that you have to have 7 spiritual children to get into heaven.
It's the MLM or pimping scheme where you get new recruits.
And my question with that is like, do those, the ones that have like come and left count, or do you have to have like,
oh, absolutely. They were definitely profited on at some point. Even if you let's say in pimping, like even if you just get one trafficked girl one time, if you profited on her that one time, it's still a profit.
It's worth it.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So like, this is all really important. So she did her course. She got pulled from the overflow room. She got matched with your dad at random, married, blessed under Reverend Moon. And then the hometown Providence, that was specifically named hometown Providence because Moon was like, okay, the heat's high on MFT and all our activities, like go back home, like disappear and spawn and recreate. We'll call it hometown Providence. It's really tactically smart that he did that. But like, we have this lens and I'm trying to peel it off. It's not just, you know, spiritual course, providence, all this. It's actually like him avoiding the law, pulling the
heat off. Intentionally.
Yeah, it's all very intentional. So this is like two worlds colliding, trying to figure it out. So interesting. And we didn't even get into your childhood yet.
I think also with that too, like part of that was they were right out of like, legit church jobs, and like these couples were starting to have children, they couldn't afford to feed their children, so they had to like kick them out of these church jobs in order to like, you know, actually have enough money for the people who were higher up in the hierarchy to be able to pay for their kids and finance their families. At that time, I think my mom was very focused, like even when she joined the church at 21, she was like, I'm looking for an intentional community to build a family in. She was really focused on having children. Like the first thing, I don't know why they always tell this story, but she and my dad say the first thing they talked about when they got matched was how many kids they wanted. And she immediately said, as many as I can have. And I know we don't have any direct ties, kind of like the Mormons do, that you're like populating the physical world from the spirit world. Yeah, but it's still like, oh, I'm gonna create as many heavenly soldiers as I can. In order to like advance the providence, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that was part of the have dominion, and that part of that dominion saying was having kids, like be fruitful. They called it being fruitful, another loaded language. But and then also Reverend Moon, you know, had what, 13 kids with Hawk Jahan. So it was definitely I think it was definitely conscious influence from the church to have as many kids as possible. But that also makes me want to ask, how did your mom grow up? Like, what was her religious upbringing?
Oh, okay. So my mom was, I wouldn't say born again because she grew up in the church, but a very poor family. Her childhood started in Oklahoma. I think they went back and forth between Oklahoma and Arizona several times, trying to settle and find farmland, essentially. But the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma made it very hard to plant any crops. Wow. I found out in recent years that going back in her lineage. I think to her, her grandmother came from a family that owned slaves. So I assume that they were somewhere in the rural South, and like 30% of whites in the rural South in the 1800s had slaves, regardless of like economic status. Like they were very poor, but like they were not poor enough to not own slaves or not, you know, participate in that culture. And I think that also, you know, really influenced my mom. She really didn't jive, I think, a lot with racism. So I think that like, it's funny though, because like a lot of the whiteness in the Unification Church is just like appropriating Asian cultures to like fill this void that white people, especially in the United States, have created like as an exchange. Like we got rid of our cultures in order to adopt like the American whiteness and the American ideals of like patriotism, exceptionalism, what have you. She was the first person in her family to go to college. She had a full ride scholarship because she was a writer and an artist, and she applied herself. She was approached on the, well, I think she actually approached the person who ended up bringing her in because she heard her lecturing about Christianity, and she was like, that's not true. And so the recruiter was like, oh, let's talk about it. And then they set up like a later meeting. And I don't really know what the rest of her course was from there. I know that she did, you know, witnessing and fundraising for many years. I don't think she was a captain, but my dad was. He's also a state leader for certain times. And he was assigned, you know, Taiwan in the early 90s to go and be a national messiah too. I think it was when I was in utero, so it would have been 91. And I've asked them about it recently, and I think that was for like 6 weeks, saying how it was, but I've done some research about like Taiwan. For like 20 years, they didn't allow any religious expression of any kind before the 90s. So it was essentially since like the early 70s that they hadn't had any religious contact.
They were ripe for the colonizing for Sun Myung-moon. Man, all of this is so deliberate and well thought out. It's like, really, who was organizing this? Like, whoever was on top of your dad basically just sent like, hey, go spread my word in Taiwan. They just opened up. They're ripe for the picking. Mm-hmm. That's so, it makes you wonder really who's pulling the strings and how did they get their intel?
I'm sure it had to do with, you know, anti-communist efforts in the area as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we weren't the only cult going in and doing this. Like, I think the Children of God were also doing this. Like one of the most similar cults that I've heard is the Children of God also did overseas missionary work to spread their gospel. But anyway,
so that wasn't, if that had gone better, it's possible we might have moved to Taiwan when I was, you know, an infant, but it didn't. So I think he got a church job at a jewelry store. They also owned a jewelry chain in the 90s called Christian Bernard.
Yes. Yep.
So he worked for them, I think, for the early years of my life, but they went under, I'm not sure exactly when, I think around 2000. And essentially after that, we were, you know, destitute. My mom didn't work. She had been, you know, bringing us in and out of homeschool, trying different intentional community schools. But I think she really took her new mission as being like the primary caretaker of this little brood of wild feral children. Yeah, so I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger sister. The age spread between my oldest sibling and my youngest sibling is 8 years.
Okay, yeah, wow. So your parents were very active, doing a lot in your formative
years.
Yeah,
my mom had wanted to be a teacher when she was in university. And I think that, she saw the church as a way to, you know, apply those skills, especially in, you know, witnessing or in like our upbringing. So I'm fortunate in terms of like our homeschool, because she was always associated with like a homeschool program that was giving us like accurate materials. We weren't getting, you know, Christian Science like bullshit. Like she did not believe in evolution, but like she wasn't trying to hide us from like the reality of science per se. I think that for me, I did a kindergarten in an intentional school. Then she pulled us and I did first and second grade and half of third grade homeschool. And then when I was in third grade, I think there was like a big workshop where Reverend Moon wanted all of the mothers to attend. I think it was the start of like ancestor liberation. So she put us in public school so that she could go attend this workshop. And following that, she was like, oh, this is, I'm going to try to start witnessing again.
Oh no. So when you were in third grade, your mother got pulled away for the cult effectively.
Yeah. I think that she didn't do so much again, because we were very poor. It's interesting because like we didn't have health, but my older siblings don't remember how poor. I think it went on stage.
Oh, hold up. All right. So your siblings didn't realize how poor you were. It was the last thing I heard.
Yeah. I don't know. It's been a while since I've tried to breach the subject with them. And I think we were intensely lucky because my dad hadn't completely cut ties with his family, or they hadn't cut him off. So when they moved here, my grandmother helped them buy a house. And before they bought the house, she had like a rental apartment. So she was leasing essentially at cost. And we were paying like $100 a month for rent in the Bay Area. And like, wow. It wasn't as bad as it is now, but like, I think that was still at least, you know, a third of what most people were paying for rents. And like I said, fortunately, it brought us farther away from the church community. Like the church in the Bay Area has a school they run also out of the church building. And most of the people that lived close enough went to those schools for K-8. So I think that like for me, the indoctrination wasn't as intense as many of my peers.
Wow. Was your mom with you, or was she doing missionary work?
I think she was mostly at home. I don't remember exactly what, you know, the extent of her activities were because I was a child.
Yeah.
But most of the time she was just staying home. I think she did try to get back into like youth ministry. She was doing like a lot of the summer camps, either as like a cook or for the little kid camp, like the family camp. She was doing group leading.
That just like made me flash back to all the camp memories and seeing all the what we would call aunties like slaving away for free in the kitchens and like just being so self-sacrificing so we could have food.
The irony is that they didn't actually have to do that. If you had money, you could pay so that you didn't have to, you know, work the camp. You could just have a nice experience with your family.
I remember I was on the poor end too. And so like signing up for maintenance, or like they had little jobs you could do to pay for your stay. Like I remember waking up at like 5 o'clock in the morning to make breakfast for the whole camp at like 12 years old. Those were the positions available, like if you wanted to stay. So I get that part too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Like at that point, I like, you know, I don't want to say that all queer and trans people, you know, have markers in childhood, but like I was very clearly like a gender deviant child. Like I would say until I was in like third grade, like I dressed however I liked, and usually that was to look like a little boy. Yeah. I do think I had longer like shoulder length hair, which could still be, you know, construed in that way. And like, I like to be outside. I liked to read. I was always doing, you know, stuff mostly by myself. I think that I don't remember a lot of that early socialization. Like, I don't even remember having, you know, friends in the church until around the time I started going to school, which was in like third grade. But I know that I did, because there are photos of us, myself and other people my age, as, you know, small children playing together.
You being like a genderless child is like the ideal Mooney, though. Like you were supposed to look femme. You were just supposed to look genderless and like asexual, bringing no attention to yourself. So you were doing the perfect child, blessed child. Do you think that strikes with you?
I would say so, but my mom definitely did try to dress me and my sisters in dresses. Okay. And I think when I was a small child, I didn't care.
Oh.
Like I didn't really associate them with being a girl or being like feminine.
Yeah.
I did often want my dresses to have shorts underneath because I was, you know, climbing trees and stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
But once I realized that they were, you know, feminine, I started like veering away from that and wearing just like shorts again, of course, you know, to your fingertip length, and like baggy t-shirts. And Yeah, I would say in fourth grade, I started to like develop breasts, and it was one of the most traumatic things for me because like before that, I was fine with everything that I was working with. And I don't have a small chest. I have like massive titties, to excuse my language. And I have memories of like other kids like running up to me and grabbing my boobs and squeezing them and running away.
Whoa.
And like trying to like chase them down and be like, hey, you shouldn't do that. But just being like so enraged that like someone had invaded my space, my body like that.
Is that in the church or is that?
No, those were outside other school friends.
Okay.
Friends, you know, I use that term very loosely.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because before I went to school, I didn't really have many friends. I wasn't a very social child, again, probably because I innately felt this difference. Like I didn't feel like I really fit in with the girls or the boys. But okay. Like when I came to public school in third grade, I think because I was like a new student, I was, you know, interesting and I was smart because I'd been doing homeschool with my older siblings. So I was doing work that was like 3-4 grade levels above where I was supposed to be. So I got like fast tracked into all these like gifted programs.
Oh wow.
But yeah, I don't really care about that anymore. It just is interesting because now I have a critical lens and I can see that they use gifted programs as a way to like segregate public schools essentially.
So it sounds like you grew up on the outskirts, but your parents were deeply submerged in the theology.
Absolutely, yes. Even though we weren't going to church every Sunday, we were getting up at 5 a.m. every day. We had to wear white to do pledge, Hunduke every morning, regardless of, you know, weekday or not.
Hunduke every morning. So that's what time is that, like every morning?
6 a.m. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my dad was also doing it with us.
I was doing it too. Okay. So basically, like how do you feel like that influenced how you felt about, I mean, I guess you're in third grade. You're not even having sexual experiences yet. Are you like starting to explore yourself? Like how does...
So it's interesting that you asked that question that way. The year before that, I had been, you know, in a homeschool program that we would meet up with other families and do like arts and crafts or like science projects or field trips. And I was in like a Girl Scout troop, and I had several friends in this Girl Scout troop, one of whom was like obsessed with like playing house and like approximating like courting rituals. So she always wanted to play this game where we were like boyfriend and girlfriend. And of course I was always the boyfriend. and like, I didn't think anything of it. I was just like, whatever. Like, it's interesting because I didn't have a lot of cognitive dissonance about it. It was because I was like so submerged in both. It was like, oh, both of these things are just natural in the way the world is. So it's not a big deal. And I guess like my siblings and I also played house, but we like focused on like the sibling aspect. So like I was an adult, which is weird. And then my brother was a dog. And then my sister was a cat. And my youngest sister was, she had many roles. We would call her either baby gorilla or the runtus among us. And I don't know what those two things mean, you know, but she was a gorilla and she was in this weird family with us. But with my school age friends at that time, they were playing like, again, like house. And so at one point this girl was like, okay, you're going to meet this Backstreet Boy and you're going to, we're going to go on a date and then we're going to come back to my house and you're going to kiss me. So like she kissed me against this doorway and I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, didn't hate it. it wasn't something I was like initiating, and I think this is very normal for kids that age. They're mirroring, you know, they're matching behaviors that they're seeing either in their parents or in TV shows that they're watching, trying to figure out what it is to be a normal person, to be a girl, to be a boy. And we didn't have TV, so I didn't really have that. I just had, you know, our weird family and what my friends would tell me about some very minimal musical influence and very heavy, you know, Bible indoctrination as well. I think the first time I learned about sex, I was like 4 years old, and my dad had told my older siblings, and they came to me and were like, "We know something you don't know, haha." And I was like, you know, an intellectual child. I was like, "This isn't fair. You have to share this information with me. Tell me what they know." And so my dad like pulled me aside on our porch. He's like, "Sex is when a penis enters a vagina." And I'm like, "What's a penis?"
No.
Like, "Oh, it's a male." I don't know if I said that exactly, but like, you know, you don't have any concept because like,
oh, no.
I had one brother and he was older, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to be like undressing him. So I didn't know what a penis was. So he told me that and I was like, "Oh, okay." And I remember asking my parents later too, like, okay, I'm assuming they showed me like an anatomical pictures or something like that.
Okay.
I was like, okay, how does the boy know which hole to put it in?
No way.
Because I understood that like there was a urethra, there was a vagina, and there was an anus, right? So I knew that there were three holes, even as like a 5 year old.
Yeah, of course.
And I was like, and my mom was just like, "Oh, he'll know." It's like, if he's a church member, he might not, but you know, whatever.
Okay. So they're telling you about sex, the anatomy of it. What?
Like explicitly.
Yeah, very detailed. Were they telling you anything about the fall of Eve or the parallels of history? Or anything like that?
I think so. I remember, you know, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So I got that, how was like the influence of the church on your childhood, on your sexual development? Because it sounds like you were on the outskirts. For me, the church and my sexual development were like integrated into, because I was going to New Hope School. So it was like constant reconditioning for believing like the fall of Eve was very literal and all this other stuff.
But it's interesting because I don't remember when these things happened, but they definitely were, you know, using fall of man, using, you know, four position foundation, like all those tools, like explaining the course of human history and why there's the need for the change of bloodline, whatever all that stuff is. Like, yeah. All this gobbledygook that a child cannot, you know, fathomly, you know, critically examine.
Right. But you can have the emotional ramifications of those stories, like feeling the weight of humanity on your decisions.
Yeah. So I do think that my mom was like, all of human history has like convened in order for you to be born, right? Like very early on, putting that really strong, like, this is what you were born for. Like, this is the purpose of your creation, to use a church term.
Right.
And talking about like why you need to stay pure. And like, even though as a small child, they were explicit about talking about sex. Like they didn't talk about like anything besides that PIV, penis and vagina, like stuff. They didn't get into why dating is wrong. Cause you know, children aren't dating. I think they did address like crushes, like, oh, you might have a crush on somebody and you know, while it might feel good, you know, you don't want to like give into that or associate with that kind of feeling because it'll grow.
In third grade, by the time you were in third grade, did you identify as a blessed child? Like, would you call yourself a second gen blessed child?
I think so.
Okay. So that in and of itself shows that you are already like influenced to identify that you were different, that you had to remain pure, that you were blessed, if that's how you identified.
I'm sure it was. I mean, it's again very interesting because like so I've been to grad school now. I have a master's in clinical psychology, and one of my research interests is like the intersections of like queerness and religion, right? And they have found through repeated studies that children who are queer that grow up in religious households go through identity issues much earlier because they're being taught this stuff in the church, right? And like queerness is inherent, it's intrinsic. It's not something you can repress or change. They do repress it and it causes, you know, issues for our mental health and for our self-identity. But because of that, we go through a lot of these identity stressors way earlier. So I think that even if I wasn't consciously aware of these conflicts, they were still like battling, you know, internally. And I think I mentioned this in our last podcast that, like, as an adult, I've had to do a lot of like reparenting and thinking about what it would be like to be raised as a gender expansive or gender diverse, have any of that shame or like expectation put on you, like just being able to explore different aspects of gender, of makeup, and not have it associated with anything like male or female, or like a value determination that like if you don't stay pure and like get married to a man and have little heterosexual babies, like your parents aren't going to go to heaven, and like you're going to be the cause of suffering for God, you know, for eternity until they restore you later on. Like, so that's not just Moonies, like all queer people that grew up religious, confusion and conflict much, much earlier. So I think I must've been going through it at that time. And I would say that, like, so going back to the story with my little friend who liked to play house, eventually came to the point where she's like, we should have sex. And I was like, I don't think so. And she's like, oh, we can just pretend. So I was like, all right, that's fine. You're not a boy, so it should be fine. And so we had, as me and my siblings, my brother had his own room and me and my sisters shared a room. Yes, we had this like three-layer loft bed. And so me and this girl like had our little date or whatever. And I was pretending to be a Backstreet Boy. So we went up to the loft and like we took off our pants. I think we were still wearing underwear, but we were like simulating sex. And we're like, oh, this is interesting and weird. And my mom comes in and she just yells the word, no. And I don't remember what happened, like how we got off the loft bed, but essentially she like grabbed my little friend and like took her home and like left me with nothing. There was no debrief, no explanation of like why she reacted that way. And I think in some senses, because she and I have talked about this at length since I've been an adult several times, she was like, I was just trying to like end the situation as quickly as possible. And she thought that by not talking about it, she wasn't going to like reinforce or shame that behavior. But that initial like reaction, I think, in some ways like classically conditioned me, like anytime that things were going to become physical with a girl going forward, I like had like a really strong adverse reaction. And like anytime like someone would invade my privacy again or touch me non-consensually, like in a sexual way, like that girl did with my chest in like fourth grade, I would like become enraged and like try to take action. I was like, I don't want to have that reaction again. I don't want people to like, I didn't realize what I'd been doing, you know? And like, again, it's a completely normal thing that so many kids do and go through. And to have that shame put on it and that strong adverse reaction from my mom, she didn't like make sure that I never saw that kid again. I was still in the same brownie troop with her. And I still went to her house. The next time it happened and she tried to like kiss me or whatever, I was like, I'm not doing this. And I literally left her parents' house and walked to my grandmother's house that was across like a busy thoroughfare. And this was in like, again, second grade. So I don't even know how old you are, seven in second grade, like.
So
an inflated responsibility for sure.
That sounds like a core memory, like a blueprint for sure.
Absolutely. And interestingly from like third point on, I like repressed that. I didn't think about it. I just completely shut it out of my mind. I was like, that didn't happen. But interestingly, I, at that time, associated because of what my mom was telling me about like my body and about purity and how we have to like, you know, do things as women to control other people's perceptions of us. I was like, that was my fault. It was my fault because I didn't stop it because I didn't realize what was happening. And, you know, I have to make sure it doesn't happen again, essentially. Like, it's my responsibility to protect myself. And at that time, I think I also had broken my arm. So my activity level drastically changed. But I remember thinking, if I'm not attractive, then no one will do this to me again. So I started intentionally gaining weight. And, like, I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm, like, a super fat person, but I'm, like, a larger person. And like from that time onward, like my mom got really concerned about it. And she was like asking doctors, like, why is this happening? Like, you can't, like, we're not feeding her anymore. Like, or, sorry, them anymore. And they're just eating, you know, and like I think I was also using, you know, food to manage my emotions, because with four little kids and like my mom having that strong emotional reaction, my mom became someone I could no longer trust with my like emotional health. I couldn't be vulnerable with her anymore.
I mean, there's so much I want to say. Like, I feel like as a parent listening to this story, sexual experiences happen with children. Like that's what happens, mm-hmm. but it's not something to be ashamed about. It creates an opportunity for you to speak. And I wish your mom could have been there for you, because it sounds like you needed somebody to talk with you about how you felt and to make you feel safe enough to explore your emotions. And maybe you didn't want to do that. Maybe if she had talked with you about boundaries and consent and how you felt and explored your emotions, you would have the tools to navigate later in life. Do you know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Like, but that didn't happen. Everything just got shut down. And so that language was never developed early, and also damaged your relationship with your mom to such an extent that you couldn't feel safe emotionally with her anymore. And that's like, that story is so popular. That happens. That's how so many parents react to situations like that so many times. So it really like disables people from having the right tools when these situations occur later in life.
Mm-hmm. And even processing it with my mom as an adult, like repairing that relationship, she still believes that like that child assaulted me. And it's like, kids don't get this from nowhere. Like, it's possible that like she experienced some other kind of abuse and was trying to reenact that or like process that. Like, we can't know what these kids are going through because we can't ask them anymore. So like she very heavily blames the other child. And I think she never wanted to talk about it because she didn't want me to have that association that like, oh, my purity was lost or whatever. But like, I think I internalized that to an extent. It's also why I felt so separate from the church for many, many years. I was like, well, I'm already kind of fucked over. Why continue to invest in this? And like, I wasn't that interested in the idea of marrying a dude or marriage in general. Like, I liked caretaking. I liked animals. I liked children. But it's just so weird to be like, you're going to get married and have babies. That's your ultimate role in life.
Nobody ever asked you how you felt about it.
Exactly.
And that was a blueprint. Oh, mm-hmm. man, I can just imagine your mom screaming, no, and then just having that as like a blueprint reaction. Like trauma, yeah, trauma lives in your body, right? So like, anytime you have a sexual experience, it's going to bring you back to that first time and that voice, that shout.
And it's interesting too, because like after that, like because I wasn't processing it verbally, I became very hypersexual, like constantly touching myself, trying to be alone so that I could be like, what's going on over here? And like, even I think at that time I was like, this isn't normal. But like, if we had conversations about masturbation with kids as early as like toddlerhood, because you know, yeah. toddlers are touching themselves like constantly. We have to be like, no, go wash your hands. We do that in private. And it feels good. Yeah. But like, there are times when it's not something to be doing, because that's just for you and yourself until, you know, you're an adult and you feel ready and able to engage in another person in that way, you know?
I feel like for little kids, it's like, they're going to touch themselves. Just make sure they're safe and in their room. Like, it's not appropriate when they're in the classroom.
Exactly.
But like, you know, you're taking a shower, like go figure yourself out a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, with other people, yeah, you have to teach about consent and boundaries. And those are all opportunities like to do that. That should be part of our natural language, because sexuality is part of our natural oneness, our wholeness.
Absolutely. I saw a great TikTok of a mom who has, I think, an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. And she was like, I did a preliminary conversation where I was like, you know, as you're going from being a boy into being a young man, your body is preparing and readying itself for you to have sexual experiences, because, you know, that's how our species evolved, like to survive. Like, we have to have sex in order to like continue our species, essentially. And like, it's not something you can control. And as you're walking around doing whatever your regular life things are, you're going to see something and it is going to make you excited. It's not going to have any conscious connection. You know, you're not going to have any control over it and you are going to have an erection. And like, until you're an adult or until you're ready, you are the person who's responsible to take care of that erection. And its primary purpose is to achieve friction and then ejaculate. Like nothing about, you know, PIV, nothing about like partnered sex. Like it's a natural thing that your body does and you need to prepare for it, you know? And I was just like, wow, where was that for us? You know,
yeah.
You could even keep the purity stuff and the abstinence stuff and just have that as well. But you know, the abstinence culture is, oh, touching yourself is evil and it's going to make your hands fall off, or like every time you touch yourself, an angel dies. Oh, those are stuff from evangelical Christianity, not so much, you know, our propaganda and conditioning.
Ours was like, your ancestors are watching all the time. And if you start masturbating, that just means you're being possessed by sexual spirits.
Absolutely.
It's like your body is never your own. Your choices.
I also remember. Yeah. Catching my older siblings watching porn, and I was like, oh, interesting. Yeah. I never, you know, it's interesting because we didn't have really like a reporting culture as siblings, but to an extent, if your sibling has made you mad, you're like, I'm gonna get back at you by telling our parents you're doing this thing that's against the rules, you know. But that was like my introduction to porn, and like I remember starting to obsessively watch porn like when I was alone online. And I knew that there were no parents or like siblings around, to the point where sometimes I would wake up in the middle of the night and like go onto our family computer. They did not tell us the password, but the password was like Shimjung. So it was easy to guess. She would even put like the password hint because my parents would forget or like lose the internet router sometimes. So she would like write herself clues as to what the password was. But you know, you're indoctrinating these children. We know what those words mean.
Yeah.
Just gotta try it enough times.
So you were watching porn. When did you know you were like queer?
I remember having my first crush in kindergarten, and it was on my kindergarten teacher, which is like, again, a normal thing. Aww. That little kids do.
Yeah.
But I don't think I coded that as a crush until I was in like third grade in public school, and other kids were like, oh, who do you like? And I had to be like, I don't know what you mean. And I had to like I had friends that were both boys and girls, but I already knew that like I couldn't be like, oh, I like this girl. I already knew that even in like the outside world, like I couldn't say that I liked a girl. And this became like a pattern for me throughout public school. So I would just choose a random boy that I was usually friends with to be like, oh, I like that boy.
Oh no.
Because if he found out, I knew if he found out it might be a big deal, but it was something that I could like deal with.
Wow.
As opposed to like actually naming, you know, my attraction to women or to girls.
So you were already consciously like protecting yourself from persecution.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think that it was not that hard because like I can convince myself into liking men sometimes.
Okay.
Like I'm bisexual, so I like men and women and other genders too. But like as a child, it's kind of why I didn't have a lot of conflict directly around the church. I was like, oh, I guess if I, you know, I'm going to marry a boy, he must be really special and he's going to be like prepared for me. We're going to have this perfect relationship. Like it allowed me to like also disconnect from having to process feelings about crushes and natural attraction and what I actually wanted to do and express myself as.
Wow. And then you've got this like gender fluid unification church environment.
Where they're like, don't be feminine.
Yeah. Don't wear makeup. Like you have to dress like a boy. Like I wore all my brother's clothes till I was like 14, 15. And that
Absolutely.
Was fine. But it's a gender fluid environment. So let's say like, did you go to camps like Camp One Heart or?
I did. I went to One Heart every year starting in like sixth grade.
Yeah.
One Heart's interesting,
yeah.
Right? Because the first time you're really in like a group and they're teaching like the Fall of Man lecture. And for One Heart, I don't know if they in recent years have done this, but in the mid 2000s, it was very segregated by gender. Like the middle school camps, you were in groups just of your gender. And then you would sit on opposite sides of the room. All your leaders were of the same gender. And then I think in high school, they did integrated groups, but you still couldn't sit next to someone of the opposite sex. You had to always be in a group of more than one of either gender. So you couldn't be a girl hanging out with a group of guys, and you couldn't be a guy hanging out with a group of girls. There had to be at least two of your gender in mixed groups, which I always thought was like very funny. And so did other people that were, you know, in that environment. We used to like prank each other by just running up to a group of guys, be like, oh no, now it's a posse. Ha ha ha.
I want to
break it up.
I just want to quickly interject, like in the cult dynamic, following Robert J. Lifton's 8 criteria of thought reform, that is like perfect number one milieu control, which is like tiny details, high control. Like not only were we segregated, but we knew which side of the room we had to go on. Like I can bet you $100 the side of the room that you had to go on, it was on the left side.
Absolutely. The left is the object side.
Exactly. Like that's milieu control. That's like the 8 that ticks off one of the biggest criteria for thought reform is just milieu control. And like, so women or female assigned at birth, always on the left side, men always on the right. Yes, I remember the group dynamics too. That must have been so... See, I remember in these group dynamics, it was very... gender fluid, but also non-consensual touch, like a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Like we couldn't identify as girls because that was bad. That was evil. But then also like if you're falling asleep, somebody would just randomly massage you, or like we would have to hold hands for long hours of prayer. Like people, I remember praying and getting so uncomfortable having to hold people's hands. Like whoever was next to you, you had to hold their hand and get all sweaty. Absolutely. And gross and pray. And just like, I just remember it reinforced for me, like these ideas of lack of identity because I couldn't express who I was. And also like non-consensual touch is just something you're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. It's interesting because, following that childhood experience, I became very conscious of how I touched other people because I didn't want to do that to anyone else also. And like, even though I wasn't, you know, assigned male, I was still listening to all this propaganda about like how to prevent like sexual things from happening, how to prevent boys from, you know, objectifying girls and how to like control that. So I don't think I was usually initiating those kind of touches, but absolutely like being massaged and touched by, you know, older girls, like
felt good, even if it wasn't actually like a healthy, you know, or consensual dynamic. Like, and I did not want people to know that I was queer because like, if they did, then they would no longer like engage with me in that way, you know? And I don't know if other camps did this, but at One Heart for sure, in these, you know, sex segregated parts of the groups, they would have like, they would assign you a certain group member to be like your special friend. And essentially it was like, you were supposed to be really nice to them. You were supposed to do like acts of service to them, give them gifts, write them notes. And like, you would enlist other girls to like bring them something and be like, this is from your secret sister. She loves you. It's just so wild because like, that was like romantic training, like to teach you how to, you know, give of yourself, like essentially unconditionally and not expect anything in return. Like, again, setting it up for a later dynamic in life in which women are doing all this service and doing all this care and, you know, support tasks. And the man is supposed to, or women give like beauty and the man gives love back in like the give and take relationship or whatever.
I remember that. It's also setting you up for flirty fishing and love bombing and recruiting and complete subjugation of whatever.
Yeah, like ignore how you feel and just continue to do this because it's for the sake of the other person, right?
Yeah, it seems like so low stakes play to just assign somebody a secret sister, but like in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about a mastermind cult, like a mastermind psychologically manipulating cult. So all of this stuff starts very subconsciously, very young. So you had assigned a secret sister, basically peer policing too, because like, I'm sure you always had your eyes on your secret sister.
And never mind when like I actually had a crush on a girl or wanted to befriend someone, like I had no idea how to do that because I had been, you know, in homeschool or in public school where people just decided that they liked me through proximity. Like I always felt, you know, distanced or alienated from like these group dynamics. Like I didn't feel like a girl or a boy, like neither of those things felt like they applied to me. And at the same time, I was applying both gender roles to myself too, because I was like, oh, well, if I'm experiencing, you know, attraction to girls, like I have to apply the same kind of paradigm that I already know about, you know?
That just must be really hard because there's only two clear-cut gender roles and assignments in the unification chart. It's either like be the man and have dominion or be the woman and be fruitful. So what's in between that? And so you took on both like responsibilities, or how did you navigate that?
I would say so, yeah. Like it's interesting because there wasn't conversation about trans people. Like besides, you know, the one thing that Reverend Moon said was that transsexuals will be like the downfall of America and blah, blah, blah. But like, I did always, you know, really wish that I was a boy. Like playing video games was actually very gender euphoric for me because I got to let go of the roles that I was assigned in being a girl. And I got to like be an adventurer and like save a princess, you know, like, and like I never really knew if I wanted to be a boy or if I just wanted the freedom that being a boy like granted, both inside the church and out.
Because like, I don't want to speak for
our brothers, because I know that their sexual policing was also so intense and so detrimental as well. But like,
they were definitely
allowed more freedom than we were, I would say, in terms of their expression. Like,
again, I was a
feminine boy though, so I can't say how that was.
Yeah, and like
at that kind of transitional stage, I started being very online. I was like a really big reader, and around I would say like 13, I started seeking out other people's opinions about the books that I was reading, and like I wanted to like talk about them critically. And so I met this group of mostly other teens. There were some adults mixed in that were like aspiring writers, and that some of them were also, you know, religious. Now, retrospectively, a good portion of us were queer, but it was essentially like a safe space to explore gender and sexuality and raunchy jokes that had nothing to do with the church, nothing to do with mainstream culture. It was like
dirty and weird
and forbidden, but also I felt so liberated in that space. And like, I didn't have to like even engage with my physical body, right? Because it's just like your mental projection in conversation and how you represent yourself. It was the first time I really had control over my image and what people were perceiving me as.
How did you meet these people?
Yeah, so
there was a book that I read that I was very critical of. The book was Aragon by Christopher Paolini. It's essentially a Star Wars knockoff with dragons. So it's like a chosen one narrative, and I was like, I don't remember exactly what my critique was, but I was frustrated with the book and like the sequels. And so I started searching online for the book title, looking for reviews and things. And then I found a like IMDb forum for an upcoming screen adaptation of that book, and other people were talking about how they disliked the book there. And one of these people,
I'll use
their internet name, which was Silver. Silver created this separate messaging board specifically for writers and for people who wanted to talk about writing as a craft and reading and like look at those things critically. And so I joined the forum, and then they had group chats, you know, almost every day. So I started like engaging in the forum, and they were like, oh, why don't you come to a chat? So I started coming to these chats every day in the afternoon after school. And they would go, you know, long into the night. Like, I think it's where a lot of my sleep issues started, was staying up late to talk to these people. And Silver and I, like, I would say I was really invested in talking to this group of people for like from 13 to like 17. And Silver and I had like a weird, like prototypical like relationship, where we were joking about dating and being girlfriends, but we weren't serious because they were a Mormon and I was a Mooney. And we talked about that too. But yeah, it was, we would often both be in the chat room, but be talking, you know, privately the entire time, every day. And so like, I think that without intervention, I probably would have fell out of the church naturally, as like, I was accepting my sexuality. But in like sophomore year, I would say my best friend's older brother attended NGA, and that was the second year. And they were starting like a summer program that was gonna be 40 days long. They needed bodies essentially, because it was a new program. No one had heard of it. Siblings were often the first people they pulled. I spent so much time in their household as a kid that they kind of were like, oh, Kale, would you like to come to this program? So my best friend and I went, and that's really the first time I felt accepted at the church, and like also love bombed. And NGA is interesting because they use like the regular cult stuff, or they did when I was there. In later years, they divested and removed anything Mooney from curriculum or programming or scheduling. But they add like breakthrough activities and like self-help jargon in order to utilize like emotional experiences as transformative. So they were doing things like bungee jumping, like high ropes courses, things that like really accelerate like emotion, like in your body, and then using the emotion as like an internal goal. Like fundraising, you always had like an internal goal in addition to your external goal. And you were using whatever experience you were going through as a way to like get to that internal goal. And I had like this transformative experience where I was digesting like my family dynamics, and I had a lot of rage toward my older brother, especially because he started using drugs, I want to say at like 13. So at this point I was 16. So this would have been like 5 or 6 years into the course of his drug use and like his struggle with the church. And like my mom,
I want to say
at like the time I was like 12 years old, started relying on me heavily for emotional support. And they call this, you know, parentification, where an adult puts, you know, not even unnecessary, but like really harmful expectations on a relationship with a child, and requires them to do emotional labor in order to get their own needs met. So my mom was using me essentially as her therapist and her way to process her emotions, dealing with both of my older siblings' struggles as they were, you know, forming and leaving the church.
Yeah, I think that's like emotional dumping. But the worst part, and I call it emotional abuse, is because they dump on you and then nothing actually changes. Like they just keep dumping the same garbage on you without breaking the cycle. So it's just like traumatizing repetitively.
And if she was like, oh, what do you think about this? And if I had been, you know, emotionally mature, I could have been like, well, you can't control what he does. You have to set an emotional boundary. And then maybe she would have done that, and then things would be different. But it was like the same conversation over and over again, where I was angry because he was like obviously harming her, but then it was in turn harming me.
Yeah.
And I think I let go of a lot of that during this NGA program, using these emotional experiences. So I had like a net positive experience. Like I made friends at that time that I'm still in contact with, folks who have exited the church, who I care quite deeply about still, you know?
Yeah.
but like that summer like convinced me that like, oh, maybe I do need to like, you know, get with the church more. And there was like an older sister on the program. I had been talking to this boy extensively at school who really liked me and had liked me for several years. And he was starting to like make physical moves on me. And so like, I shared this like at the beginning of like the summer program or whatever. And she was like, you have to break up with him. You have to tell him, you know, I don't want this. We can't continue this anymore. It's not part of my religion. You know, I'm going to have an arranged marriage. And like, at first I was like, no, but this pretty and kind older girl that I really liked was, you know, influencing me. So eventually I was like, okay, you're right. I am misinterpreting this boy that I mostly find as like an annoyance, even though we're friends and I like him. And so I broke things off with him and I was like, oh, I really got to like commit myself to the church. I've got to like find God. I've got to do all this stuff, you know? And none of it's real. It's all control. It's just, yeah, you know, keeping you in. But without that like intervention from her, I think that I might've just gone, you know, back to public school and continued that relationship with that boy or ended it, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I am
back and I was like, I've got to get out of public school. I'm wasting my time here. I want to go into NGA full year. So I pulled myself from public high school and I finished my last 2 years of high school in 1 year.
Did they make it
through independent study?
They made you want to do this. I'm sure like you really wanted to escape public school to go to NGA because let me guess, they made you super shameful about your life at home that you had built for yourself and then offered you like an alternative route. So like with a lot of gumption, you were like, yes, I feel so manipulated. Like looking back, I'm like, they manipulated you to think that what you had was bad and that your individual existence was not living up to some ideal.
Because of the love bombing from this older girl, which, you know, is my natural preference is towards women, like attraction wise. I was like, oh, absolutely, this boy doesn't matter to me. Like this is so much more good and wholesome, normal, not even processing like that attraction piece. And I'm sure, again, it was more of that non-consensual touch where she's like touching my shoulder or holding my hand as we're processing this emotional stuff that, you know, is how they got people.
Man.
Like, I don't know when or how our parents like trained us to do that, but that was ingrained.
It sounds like you got converted again. Like for me, my identity as a second gen was solidified because I went to all the schools. But for you, it sounds like you kind of lived on the outskirts and then got witnessed to at this NGA program. Like they won you over.
Absolutely.
Even at that program, I thought that, you know, my close friend might have been queer because she had like this deep relationship with another woman that was on the program. And I was like, oh, maybe I could continue to like be queer in the church, you know? So I made like getting onto NGA full time like my goal.
Yeah. I want to say like my dad accused me of being bisexual with my best friend. And I'm not denying that that was some of the dynamics that were at play, but also like I don't have the language for it because of this constant state of trauma, but I was also really depreciated of love and physical touch and being queer. Like joking about being queer in the church was almost a safe place. Like, but only joking. Cause if you were serious, then you get sent to Chumpyung. But if you were just like, oh, I'm just gonna like, I would just sit on other girls' laps. I would like be like, hey, you want to take a shower with me? Like in GOP, like I would have ice cream parties in the shower room with like a bunch of other naked girls. And like, yeah, no. And or in Chumpyung, I mean, we had to take showers together. So why not make it like a little bit queer and a little bit fun and playful? But if anybody like suspected you of being serious, I can't imagine what that was like. Cause like I came to terms with my sexuality in a very cognitive dissonance way. Like I was completely separated from my sexuality. So I would see my body doing these things, but I wasn't actually there in my body doing those things. Is that?
Maybe we were trying to disconnect from our bodies and to not process as a whole person.
Yeah. Like I remember playing shower tag, but like if I had been in my body and be like, oh, this is a sexual experience, it would have been high stakes, like too high stakes to be present in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
As I was realizing that there were some experiences I had with like close friends from my local community that, like, looking back, I can be like, oh, that person was making a pass on me. Like, if I had been open, we could have like cuddled or made out at that time. But like, that was so forbidden that like, and I was already, you know, consciously controlling my interactions with other women and like how I related to my friends, especially.
Yeah.
My best friend, interestingly, grew up in a family that didn't touch at all. Very rarely would they hug.
And
it was interesting because when she came on NGA, when we were on NGA together, she like became incredibly touchy and like to the point where it was uncomfortable to me because I was witnessing this dramatic shift. And like, I was like, oh, I thought we were both in a place where like we didn't do that, you know?
There's also different types of intimacy.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to pause it real quick to explore the types of intimacy that I'm aware of to give language to further expand beyond just horizontal, vertical, conjugal, and parental relationships that the Unification Church espouses constantly. So intimacy can be broken down to many different types of intimacy that are outside of sexual and romantic intimacy. There's also physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, creative intimacy, intellectual intimacy, aesthetic intimacy, and then there's also experiential intimacy. So those are just some types, those are just some branches. Just because you're attracted to someone or have an intimate connection with someone doesn't mean it's sexual or romantic. And then we can go into the types of sexualities, but we won't here. I just wanted to branch off and pause real quick because I think that's important. It's good to have language in your toolbox if once you were raised in a cult. It can help you look at reality a little bit differently. So there you go. Let's get back to the episode. There, you know, there's like romantic or sexual or just intimate, playfully. Yeah. So I think we're all like also exploring all those dynamics, but man, I'm like in a flashback right now. I'm just like skipping through all these chapters of my life of sexual development. And like, I just kind of realized like I was never really in my body because it wasn't safe.
Yeah, you're terrible.
It's so terrible. And like imagining what it would be like to have those experiences now as an adult and like realizing that all of this stuff didn't have to be here. All of these blockages that you have to process through and like retrain your body to learn. Cause like, just like that mom said to that boy in that TikTok like about her son, like you actually have to learn how to engage with your body sexually. Cause if you you're not gonna know what to do. Like, You masturbate in order to like know what you like so that you can share this experience with a partner later on or multiple partners, you know, whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. I will say also, this is kind of an aside. I don't believe that monogamy can really exist unless you examine why you're choosing to be monogamous and you're choosing that consensually, like without any thought control, without any behavioral control. It's like a autonomous decision. Like, I recognize that I have the possibility for multiple attractions at the same time, right? I recognize that those things can come up, but I don't want to jeopardize what I have with this person unless we talk about it at length when those other attractions come up, you know? And until that happens, until those conversations happens, these are the rules I'm going to engage by. Like, because we were never taught what consent is and how to navigate consent, we never knew that, like, you can tell people when you don't want to be touched because you weren't allowed to do that. Because like, if you're falling asleep and someone massages your shoulders, like you can't tell them to bug off, you know?
No, you couldn't.
And that all starts so young.
Wow. It's like this powerlessness, helplessness. I feel like I learned about my sexuality growing up in the church, and it all did start around the workshops and like these weird dynamics, this control, this identity assignment.
These things too, prescribing these things means that you never get to freely choose them. Mm. So maybe later in life, you know, you're able to be like, what do I like about being a woman or a girl? And then you can like consciously choose to do those things if that's what you want, but not giving people the breadth of opportunity to try different things that are, you know, associated with different genders.
It's so damaging.
And like, even like the idea of like women as objects, as like someone who receives like the sexual initiation of men, it's not realistic. It's not like a healthy sexual dynamic for a woman to lay there you know, like a fish, and not engage and not be, you know, it's so funny because the church terms are the first thing that pops in my head, and not get, you know, being involved in give and take in the sexual relationship. Yeah. But like, yeah, when you objectify someone, you're treating them like a thing. They're not a person anymore. And like, that was so ingrained in the church doctrine, is that women are objects for men to obtain.
Yeah. And when you can objectify somebody like that, then you create the power dynamics of oppression and oppressed, right? So it's just this toxic cycle. And that's something I'm still healing from. So yeah, this conversation isn't easy. I don't think it could be easy to like face these things.
I've been very anxious in the lead up to talking about this. You know, I've talked about it at length, you know, with different friends, partners, therapists, but it's very different to be a public person regarding, you know, your formative sexual experiences and how they were damaging.
Yeah. A lot of learned helplessness. And I keep saying that just because like I'm reflecting on how I felt in those camps and with all, even in Ansu, like that was sexual assault. Mm-hmm. But having this like state of, yeah, helplessness. What is it called?
Learned helplessness.
Yeah.
If the listeners don't know the history of that term, it comes out of this observed condition a psychologist had, in which he had a lab that was at basement level and he had dogs that he was doing testing on. I don't remember what the context of his initial plan was.
Yes.
But these dogs were trapped in cages and there was a flood, and essentially the water kept rising and it initiated trauma responses in these dogs, to the point where they couldn't, even if the cage door was open, then they then did these other experiments where they would, you know, initiate like a shock, and they would have either a closed cage or an open cage where the dog could escape. And if the dog had gone, even if the cage door was open, they would shut down and they would cower and just receive the shock rather than trying to escape or leave the traumatic experience. Because prior to that, there was no escape, you know? And we were raised in these conditions where there is no escape. This is your identity. This is who you are. And you cannot leave. And like, that was ingrained in us, that learned helplessness. Like, you cannot take agency to go.
Oh, yeah. And that, I was just reading the book, Your Body Keeps the Score, and that's on page 29. Actually, the guys who did that experiment was Stephen Meyer and Martin Seligman. And I might be butchering it, but yeah, it's called like a state of inescapable shock. So like, no matter how much you're abused as a human in the Unification Church, you're not going to leave, because if you were abused in a way where you couldn't escape, then your body's been blueprinted to react with helplessness, learned helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, and I'm just like,
whatever we've developed as coping mechanisms, like those are not your faults. Like the coping mechanisms you have gotten you through to this point. And yeah, you can now decide whether those are still healthy coping mechanisms for you, or if they're interfering with your ability to make, you know, cognizant, empowered choices. Like if you're experiencing like a panic attack, or like you're shutting down emotionally, you can't necessarily continue to move. But like if you're in the middle of a workshop and you're shutting down emotionally, that's protective. Like that's keeping you from direct harm, you know?
Yeah. So I'm sure, like, if I'm having flashbacks right now, that listeners that are also second gen are probably having flashbacks right now. So it's probably a good time to like talk about coping mechanisms, if that's okay.
I want to say something that helps me a lot. You know, I'm going to do it right now because I'm feeling activated.
Yeah.
Is creating bi-directional like conversation throughout your body. So you can take your hand and put it on your chest. It doesn't matter which order, you know, we're not Moonies here anymore. And just put both hands on your sternum. You could also put one hand on your chest and the other under your armpit and just put pressure there. You can also tap or rock. Those are all, you know, biological coping mechanisms that we use and children use in order to like create safety within the body. So anytime you're rocking, that's helpful, because it's, again, engaging that back and forth. Singing does the same kind of thing. because it engages both your brain and your body together, but making conscious space for your body and the communication across it.
Also taking action to like interfere with the neurological networking that's already been ingrained in you, and like changing it up and just observing what your body does when we talk about these traumatic things. Mm-hmm. I think just the act of observing and intuitively changing the direction in which things go is healing the trauma.
Yeah, and part
of it too is engaging the different parts of your brain. So in our brain, the left side, right, is the analytical side, the language side. And the right side is where the emotional centers are. And like when we're in a trauma response, there's no communication between the two sides. Right. Like our brain activity is decreased. And so you want to do something that elicits the communication between those sides. Something that works for me really well too is physical weight. Like if I'm experiencing a panic attack or anxiety, like I have a chain that I wear. Wow. That's pretty heavy, like a little punk chain, whatever. And also like weighted blankets and like just that weight and having something to like touch. Yeah. Can really ground you in like this reality.
You know what you just said is that your right brain, when you're in activation with emotions, your right brain takes over, which is like your emotional and artistic, mm-hmm. creative side. And your left, and your speech center disengages, your Broca's area from, you know, I'm reading this book, so I've got it in my head right now, but your Broca's mm-hmm. area shuts down. So when you're in an illicit emotional state, your speech actually shuts down, but a way to counteract that natural occurrence is talking through your feelings and giving words to what your sensations are, just the sensations, and like re-engaging your left and right brain and building a bridge between your emotions and the language, and that like can center you, I think, mm-hmm. and get you out of that illicit emotional state and back into an equilibrium between your brain function, like literally.
Interesting, because you saying that brings up stuff about NGA for me. Like I was saying, they use these emotional experiences and like breaking through your emotions with words and with these physical actions in order to like heal, or to like encode safety or what have you, to make you feel empowered. And like just thinking about how the church even uses like real practiced stuff in order to legitimize itself, you know.
Yeah,
like that's part of why NGA was so popular, because it worked and people did feel healed. And like that was part of the initial reason why Jeff had said started the program, that he wanted to offer something to like the second generation who he saw were like traumatized and like struggling with their identity and like how they got here. Like I haven't spoken to him in many years, but I think that's what he expressed his intention was over and over again, to us at least.
With real self-help and empowerment, but still you were given a core mission.
Mm-hmm.
It was still not your time.
Ultra personal transformation.
Yeah, wow.
And like, how moony is that too? Like transform yourself to change the world.
Man, this is a trip. It feels like we keep going down the rabbit hole. I feel better. I feel less activated just because we spoke about what was going on. How do mm-hmm. you feel? Do you feel as activated as we were when we were diving into the camp experience?
No, I'm okay. Actually, I'm, you know, sitting on a bed.
Okay, cool. Cool. So we dived pretty deep into the camp experience. I wanted to ask you a question about coming out. You know, there's the term coming out in society, and there's coming out queer. There's also kind of coming out with your gender, but for you had the extra layer of coming out of not being in the church, like coming out of being a second gen blessed child. So that's like a lot of layers. Do you feel safe to dive, like to explore how that made you feel?
Yeah. So when I exited the church, I feel like because I was already kind of ingrained in other public society type things. And like, I had like ideas about what I wanted to do with a job, and I had this supportive network of friends, like, it's so complicated because like coming out for me in the church, like as queer, was over my NGA year. I had started a relationship with someone right before I joined the program. So I had already committed to be there, and I had started this new thing. And I slowly started, you know, telling people what I was going through because I was spending so much time like speaking around trying to talk to this ex of mine. And I had different reactions. The first person I came out to in the church, I believe, was Faith Yen. And Faith was like, oh, cool. People are just gay. That's fine. And it was like a complete non-issue. And I think that that made me feel, you know, comfortable and safe enough to tell other people and like to not expect the worst every single time. But within that year, I was outed to several different people at different times, where, you know, information about me was shared non-consensually. No one ever asked me if it was okay to like report these things upward. And like, I think eventually when I came back from NGA, those things or those questions about my sexuality started being, you know, raised by the general church community. And like, one of the biggest things that pushed me away was this woman that was involved with almost all of the education programs at the Bay Area Church. Came to my mom and was like, oh, it's such a shame. You know, people are asking about Kale and, you know, they're very interested in them, but you know, they're not interested in getting matched. And that was kind of the framing. And they said this to my mom, you know, after church during like the social hour or whatever, when they're eating bagels. I don't know. I don't even know, like, because I just removed myself from church events after that. Like, yeah.
It's so fucking brave that you came out as queer in the church, in NGA.
Thank you.
Like, you did that. That's cool. Like, that's very cool. That's a lot of, I have a lot of respect for you.
Yeah. Like I said, the reaction was varied. Like, Faith was like, awesome. I had queer friends, you know, in high school. I don't care. Like, that's such a cool thing to know about you. Yeah. And I think also at that time I had started processing like my early sexual experience with that other girl, and like people reacted and said like, oh, you're queer because you had that experience, including like the leader of NGA. And he tried many times to have conversations with me where he was like, this is why you're queer. You need to like cut off from that relationship. You need to like heal whatever is broken in terms of your sexuality in order to come back to like a default cis heterosexual like norm to like overcome that trauma. Cause that's also what they're always trying to do, is overcome the trauma, right?
That's so, they look at it like a brokenness, like a flaw or a fault, and that's like the wrong framework. It's just what it's that's your weird. Sexuality that's a lot of like baggage and a lot of shame to put on somebody for no reason.
You can change, like, if you're dealing with these feelings, you know, first of all, most people who identify as heterosexual have had some kind of queer contact or queer thoughts. You know, it's just part of being human. Like, this is a normal experience. And it's, you know, diverse and interesting and fun, but we have so shut down the conversation about like sexuality to the point where people don't want to address like experiences they've had that have been like, you know, inciting in like a queer sense. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And I think that's with the Judeo, like the mostly Judeo-Christian influence of one man, one woman for life. Cause that's not just a Mooney term. And just having just really stark black and white gender assignments for everybody.
And I am so fortunate that no one was like, let's send them to Chungkyung, either in terms of my sexuality or my gender, because I know that happened to so many of us queer people in the church. And I want to give space and recognize that we don't know who we've lost. We don't know what people have gone through. We don't know what kind of, you know, intense harm conversion therapy in the church has caused. Like, there might have been many people who, you know, took their own lives, that completed suicide because they couldn't reconcile, you know, who they felt, you know, at their core with the church teachings and programming. Like, we talk about the dual consciousness that's instilled and like how harmful it is to like integrate those two halves and to like recognize that, like, yeah, even if this was, you know, implanted in me, it's still something that I've dealt with, you know, in terms of the church. It's still something that I've had to like unlearn and unpack. And I want to, you know, give a shout out to all my queer and trans siblings out there. And I want to say that I'm so proud of all of you. And if you're struggling with it right now, like, we're here for you. You can reach out to me and I can get you into contact with folks who are ready to talk about this with you. You don't have to be alone in this. And I don't know what kind of resources the church is offering you, but we are here. And we have these experiences and this knowledge, and we want to share it. We don't want anyone who's young and struggling to have to go through what we went through alone, because
we have elders
now. We don't need to, you know,
continue
to go down these paths of self-shame and hatred. You don't have to accept what other people tell you, whether that's from the church, whether that's from, you know, US imperialism, that kind of conditioning. You need to look at your beliefs and the things that affect you and say, who is this serving? Does me believing that I'm inherently sinful and dirty and wrong help me in any way? And if not, why are you still believing that? Have some self-compassion. Like, it's hard and heavy work, but we're here and we're ready to do it together. You know, you don't have to be silenced anymore.
I love that. Who is it serving? I love that. That's an insightful
question. Every single belief or thought you have, you can like trace that way.
Yeah. Is my life better for believing in this?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, then why am I still believing in this? Weigh the pros and cons. If it's not in line with who you are, it's usually something you should be able to toss.
Does it encourage human freedom and liberation? Does it liberate others? Or does it, you know, force them to shrink and silence themselves?
Yeah, this is not uncharted territory. If you're walking down this as a second gen and thinking you're alone, like, we're here. We've gone through it. We're still unpacking it. Hopefully being brave and showing you how it's affected us and where we're coming from and how we're still healing can help you avoid the landmines we stepped on.
Yeah, I just had something else I wanted to bring up. Part of the reason we don't have a blueprint as to how to do this is because so many of our queer and trans elders were exterminated in the AIDS crisis. Like, the US government did not intervene and put effort into saving our lives, into saving our elders' lives. And we would have much more rich and diverse communities, but we lost an entire generation. And those that survived are often only, you know, the folks who had wealth and access in order to get to that point. And if people did survive otherwise, it was through incredible community efforts, you know, to care for them. Like, lesbians often were the only people who were willing to caretake dying, you know, gay men and trans women. And like, there's this even dichotomy that we assume from the way that like mainstream culture presents queer and trans communities, that is just completely ahistorical and out of context. It's an outsider looking in, you know, it's not real. And these people still exist. They're still living. That was 30, 40 years ago, right? And like, you can find them. Like, I absolutely encourage you to look into even the mainstream and look for people who are queer and who are thriving, you know, and who will not, you know, let people demean them or belittle them because of who they've chosen to marry or how they've chosen to dress. Like, definitely, you know, seek out others and, you know, just tell people, you know, I'm struggling with my sexuality. Like, can we talk about this? There are support groups online, even if you don't want to go to a physical space. There are people out there who are waiting for you.
Yeah. I love that you're bringing up that this is not new. This is not, like, I think there was propaganda in the, you know, 50 years ago to make America think that being queer or transgender was like a new epidemic. But I mean, in multiple cultures, in multiple religions, being trans or queer is part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm specifically learning about it on TikTok with the language of Two-Spirit, which is like the third gender in Native American culture, and finding out how normal it is that being queer and transgender is a human trait since the beginning of man. I mean, it's normal. Sexuality is fluid, and it's always been fluid. And it's the psychological warfare that's been going on in the last hundreds of years to make us think that it's not normal. And it's a cult tactic to instill shame in a very human aspect of ourselves for control, I would say.
It's interesting because the Moonies really latched on to like this idea of like the traditional family, right? But even up to 100 years ago, families weren't incorporated in this kind of way. Like there were large networks of, you know, aunts and uncles and things who were there to support families, and like families lived in community. They didn't live in these individual units. And I think that our Indigenous, you know, communities can really show a blueprint of how, you know, we could create new things. Don't want to intrude on their, you know, experiences or try to name that for ourselves, but like there's something very special about that. And scientifically, they talk about the idea that, you know, queer and trans people exist in order to provide that bigger net of community. If there are fewer children, then you have more adults available to take care of those children, you know, share the load or whatever.
Yeah, and that's seen in nature as well. I mean, there's multiple animals and birds that are gender fluid for many different reasons, like the eel. I think there's the turkey. There's all these different, in nature, it shows that the, you know, gender fluidity is natural for survival, for community, and for pleasure. It's just, it's the way.
A lot of those creatures can literally change their sex.
Exactly.
In order to make up for the lack of, you know, say males in a group. I think mostly amphibians can do that, but you see, you know, lions, there are, you know, female lions who end up growing manes and displaying like male behaviors. Mm-hmm. It's like the church has all these lies that they've told you about what nature is, like this dualistic nature. Like nature doesn't do dual, nature doesn't do a binary.
It's
like,
all on
nature's a spectrum.
Yeah, it's a spectrum.
Yeah.
For survival, for good reason, also for, you know, play and socialization. Like socialization is a huge part that's overlooked in the church too.
If you want to go further down the rabbit hole of gender fluidity in nature, look up the term parthenogenesis. That's right, parthenogenesis. Yeah, have fun with that. Let's get back to the episode.
It's incredible. It's not something to be ashamed of, is pretty much what we're getting at and trying to undo the church rhetoric of, you know, you're flawed if you're queer. It's not a flaw.
And I was going to bring this back too, to like the US culture, right? So the US culture of imperialism exists to uphold and enforce capitalism. And you can make the most profit out of people if they are separated from community, if they are individual families, right? If you break down the community into these small units that then have to depend on each other for everything, the stakes become much higher. Like you can't rely on an extended family member to take in your kids. You can't rely on, you know, taking time off from your job. Like you have to keep working, you have to keep going because there's no one else. And you have all of these bills that they're forcing on you. And it's interesting to think about our parents too, having rejected those ideas and then still being morphed back into them. Like, I think that the church and many other cults in the 70s scooped up people who are revolutionary, who were rejecting what they were experiencing and seeing, like, especially with the Vietnam War, especially with the nuclear family, especially with like this puritanical ideal. And they just, you know, tweaked it a little bit. And they were like, oh, the free sex, free love movement is like, you know, so negative and it's destroying the family. But like, there are so many people who grew up in hippie communes that were also like cults. You know, it's like the family is always going to be there no matter what, because we do pair in order to create children, in order to have deep intentional, you know, bonds with others. But like, not to this extent, not to the extent where you cannot leave, not to the extent where you're bonded for life. You know, you're not, like we were talking about in the previous purity culture episodes. You're not a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a flat soda or a piece of bubble gum. And all of that is designed to control you and to keep you plugging into this system that exploits you, whether it's the church or capitalism or another, you know, like MLM or other, you know, high control group.
Man, this is good conversation. There's so many, there's so many
specifics routes. From like my life story. We've got specifics from your life, generalizations about the church that generalize to greater society.
I mean,
the
it's
whole
all
shebang, the whole world.
It's all connected. Like in America, there's a sickness. There's an illness. I mean, 1 out of 10 people are on Prozac. I guess it doubles. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with our society, and I think you're really poking at a lot of the core issues that we don't talk about.
Hey, quick fact check. Just because I'm a nurse and it's bothering me, it's actually 1 in 10 adults in the United States has been on a antidepressant, is on or has been on an antidepressant. I just use Prozac as a general term, but let's get back to the episode.
Especially with like mental health, I work in mental health now, and like I want to say mental health or mental illness is a predictable response to stress. If you stress the body in certain ways, the mind follows. If you tell someone that like the world is failing and we're going into like climate collapse, and then no one does anything about it, they're going to be traumatized. Like if you deprive someone of sleep, of regular food, of putting them on meds and taking them off frequently, their brain is going to be in an altered state of reality. Like we've all experienced sleeplessness in the church. Like you start to hallucinate, you start to like be in between sleep and wake, like, and at that point you're very suggestible and influenceable, and our brains are, you know, these crazy sensory processing machines, but they're not machines, right? They're trained, they're animal.
This is making me think that, like, I just had this thought with learning about the terms of learned helplessness in animals with Stephen and Martin. With their experiment, I'm starting to see that on a wider scale. Like that's what's going on with us. We have this inescapable shock in our society, and we're being manipulated like putty, like animals conditioned to be helpless in this state of inescapable shock. And it's, I don't know, this isn't a political podcast, but there is something larger at play.
Can you not talk about political stuff when the church was funneling all of this money into the right wing, who, you know, does not invest in mental health care? Again, mental health care is individualizing a collective problem. That's why they have all these prescriptions that they're trying to treat people with that don't solve the root issue. You're treating the symptom, not the cause.
And
the cause is this exploitation, this disconnection from reality, from others.
Inhumanity, this propelled inhumanity for profit. I mean, from pedagogy of the oppressed, from oppressing and being oppressors, we're losing our humanity, or we never had it. We have to evolve towards it. And there's a serious illness, and it's being treated with capitalistic agendas, and it's not actually being fixed. It's being profited on.
And the only way to like overcome those things is not individually, it has to be collectively, you know? And for me, I have to believe that other people are also seeing this system and seeing the church and seeing, you know, unhealthy dynamics for what they are. Like we were raised to believe that we were special and chosen, right? But like, we're not, we're just human, and we're all just trying to learn and do better. And so seek out your fellow man, seek out your fellow person who's also doing this work. Talk about these things. Like, I know the church has like this shutdown culture that you just don't talk about these things because like you might be shamed or like coerced or forced into conversion therapy, like we were saying before. But seek out people who are safe and unpack these things together.
You kind of got derailed
from like my coming out.
I think that's why people are so obsessed with cults all of a sudden. There's been this huge craze of talking about cults and cult podcasts and cult documentaries. And I think it's because cults like reflect the extremism that people can't see in everyday culture. And it's so interesting. I just, I'm glad we got here, but yes, we will get back to this subject. of let's go back. Okay, let's go back to, yeah, coming out, right? We were talking about coming out, queer, gender, and as a second gen blessed child on NGA. Man, NGA.
Ooh, what a tantalizing ending. We actually have another hour and a half for you guys. I have to get it together, get some episode art, edit it, and I'll release it as soon as possible. I absolutely loved what we ended on. It was delicious. One of the big things I don't talk about is my experience as a nurse, seeing, yeah, a lot of these, you know, we treat the illness, but we don't treat the cause. And I view the medical system almost like a cult. And I don't say this a lot, but it's a very information controlled area. I mean, you can't even find out how much a surgery costs. I don't even know. I can't even tell you. And I'm the nurse. There's a lot of information control. There's HIPAA. There's a lot of control, and there's a lot of profits. And you know what? There's a lot of human suffering. All of it's about human suffering and profiting on human suffering. So actually the reason I do not do full-time nursing is because it's a little bit triggering. The hospital I work at is absolutely amazing, and it's not their fault for being triggering. I have the best crew that I work with, the most intellectual, empathetic nurses that you could find in the state of Texas. I work with such a good crew. It's not the crew, it's the structure. It drives me crazy. And this isn't a podcast for that, but yeah, it's something that we touched on briefly, and I just think it's amazing how diverse and dynamic this episode was, and Kale is just so, so wonderful. So come back next week when we release the second part of this amazing interview. Happy Pride Month. I hope that you got some tools out of this episode that will help you thrive as an autonomous, authentic human being wherever you are in the world today. And that healing is not linear. As you can see, we can be healed from one thing and get pulled into a flashback in an instant. But Kale gave us some amazing tools to get out of that. So I'm just so glad that they could be here with us. And look out for your mental health, okay? Take care of yourself, and we'll talk again soon.